Federal judges want photo IDs to be presented by every voter in the November 4 election. The State Department of Transportation is scrambling to find a way to issue photo IDs to what has been estimated to 300,000 potential voters. Meanwhile, there was a lawsuit filed challenging the design of the ballot, and the Government Accountability Board is working with all local clerks and volunteer poll workers on how to enforce a photo ID. And still, meanwhile, both races for governor and attorney general are dead heat. So it's a great time for a newsmakers with Mordecai Lee of UW-Milwaukee, Charles Franklin of Marquette Law School. Gentlemen, we're about 7 weeks out. It's a privilege to be a reporter and have this river of news in front of me, but I have this question. Biggest surprise 7 weeks out in this campaign season?
Go ahead.
Well, I think from the horse race side, the fact that it's dead even and has been for so long, you know, you might have thought one candidate or the other would break out by now, but there's been a lot of surprises, as you know.
I think my biggest surprise is that 5% of the population, based on your latest poll, don't have an opinion about who they're going to vote for and don't have an opinion about Scott Walker. Now, who are these people? Are they living off the grid? Are they living in a cave? That there are Wisconsinites without an opinion about Scott Walker, to me, is astonishing.
Well, Mr. Polster, who are they?
Well, they're people who, while they're registered to vote, pay less attention to politics. They tend to be under 30 or under 35. They tend to be independents and moderates. To a small extent, they tend to live in the more rural parts of the state rather than the urban centers. So there's a sort of classic, relatively uninvolved voter whose life, unlike some people, doesn't revolve around the headlines first thing every morning. All of us, and you out there, dear viewer, too. And so, you know, it's maybe not inconceivable that these people are peripherally involved. In fact, it's not at all unusual that they're peripherally involved. I agree with Mordecai, though. You know, you would think that there's been enough to sort of make everybody make up some kind of decision in this time.
Are these the late deciders? Are they going to decide based on the last TV ad that they watch?
I don't know that this undecided group is really the key there.
Okay.
In that a lot of those folks are probably not going to vote in a low turnout midterm election precisely because they're not involved and they don't have a strong preference. I do think there's a little bit bigger group of voters who are independent and moderate, make up 17% of likely voters in the state. And that means they don't have an ideological side to favor, and they don't have much of a partisan side to favor. So for them, performance in office, how well are things going in the state, and how are jobs doing, how's the budget doing, and is the direction of the state headed in the right direction? I think those things are more apt to move those voters as they hear the arguments in these last, 40-something days till election, as opposed to those folks that eat and breathe politics who are much more partisan, much more ideological, and are surely not going to change their minds. Whether they get to the polls or not is the other part. Getting the turnout, which side is favored by that, I do think is also up in the air.
I think you can add two other narratives. You know, it's fun to speculate because you don't have to base it on facts. But one of them reminds me of President Carter running for re-election in 1980. Reagan is a serious contender. The polls showed that it's winnable by either. And then on the last weekend before the presidential election in 1980, the bottom dropped out of Carter's supporters. And it was almost as if the American people who were undecided had a conference call. And they decided we're all going to break for Reagan. And then it turned out to be a Reagan landslide. So that's one scenario that might happen. In other words, in the last weekend, something will break. Another possible scenario that Charles alluded to is if people who are casual voters, we might call them presidential voters, that they don't usually vote in an off-term election, are they intimidated by the voter ID thing? In other words, the relatively casual voter are likely to be lower than average in socioeconomic status, and are more likely not to have a driver's license. Them deciding not to vote might be what turns the election.
Oh, I want to come back to the traditional betting is, in a race this close, the winner who has, the winner is the party that, the candidate who has the best ground game. In your opinion, Mordecai, you're in the biggest market, who has the best ground game? The Repubs or the Dems?
In Milwaukee County, the Dems, in Waukesha County, the Goppers. It's really astonishing the different worlds that people live in. And I'm not sure if the Dems have as good a ground game as the Obama campaign had. Okay. Because for them to win, they've got to get the Obama voters out. So I'm not sure what the answer to the question is.
Well, it's not lost on me that the state Republican Party has opened either 16 or 18 or 19 regional offices to do just this, to get their vote out. Charles, your opinion, ground game?
I think both sides have geared up on this. You know, the Obama campaign kind of pioneered social media as a way of reaching people in 2008, and then really upped the game in 2012. A lot of those people that worked for Obama went out and started companies that now Democrats around the country, and I'm not sure here in the state, but I'd be surprised if they're not involved here. And the question is, I think Mordecai puts it, is well put, that, you know, it's one thing when the top of the ticket is the President of the United States. Right. It is surprisingly harder to motivate voters further down. And the best example is, you know, between 2010 and the recall, 400,000 more voters came out for the recall. But 500,000 more beyond that turned out for November. If the recall couldn't get that extra 500,000 out, it's hard to see a more normal midterm that gets them out. And the question then is, what happens in that 400,000 between the 2010 electorate and the 2012 recall electorate? You know, I'm sort of struck by conversations I have with people who say things like, you know, oh yeah, is this an election year?
Right.
You know, they're busy with their jobs, their families, they're not tuned in. Now, I'll grant you that was a couple of months ago that I had that one particular conversation. But, you know, again, there is a segment of the population that tunes in very late and decides late whether to vote or not. I do think that, you know, with photo ID and the complications from that, perhaps this ballot format question, there could be an awful lot of late decisions and changes as we go in. Whether that'll really drive turnout, I'm not so sure, but it certainly adds a complication to the voting process this time.
Let me add another thing to that. What I liked about Charles's results from the most recent poll is he talked about the enthusiasm gap.
Yes.
Enthusiasm is slightly going up with Republicans, not with Democrats.
Quote, in the September poll, it is Republicans who have an advantage in enthusiasm. Go ahead, Mordecai, finish your thought.
I'd make the argument that maybe that means we're snapping back to normal, because low turnout elections, in other words, non-presidential elections, skew Republican. Why? Because the lower the turnout, the more demographically it represents Republicans. So it could be that you finding that enthusiasm is the normalcy of a midterm election of exactly what happened 4 years ago.
Now, Mordecai, you live and work in the state's largest media market. You see ads that I don't see in the Madison market. Who's winning the ad wars so far at this moment?
What was interesting to me is that Scott Walker lost the previous round of ad wars. In other words, Scott Walker was on the attack. He was attacking outsourcing. He was attacking everything he could about Mary Burke. And apparently, his internal numbers didn't change at all. And then all of a sudden, about a week and a half ago, Walker announced that he was going to start doing positive advertising. So that indicates to me that the previous round didn't work, and he and she are still looking for the way to unlock the undecideds, because so far nothing is working for either of them to get beyond their base.
So do you think the internal Walker polls that only he and his top advisors see exactly parallels Charles, that is an absolute dead heat, and he could be defeated on November 4?
I think he's more likely to win than to lose, but I think his internal results and the way he's behaving since then correspond perfectly to what Charles is coming up with.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Charles, I want to ask you about the results yesterday. Burke is viewed favorably by 36% of registered voters, unfavorably by 35%. 29% say they haven't heard enough or don't know how they feel about her. Now, the Walker numbers. Walker viewed favorably by 49%, unfavorably by 45%, only 5%. We're talking here about a difference of 24 percentage points. Does the 29 who don't know Burke well enough Does that give the Walker campaign a target trying to get swing them over to him?
It certainly gives them a target, but it's worth noting that that target has been out there all year. Back in the spring, Democrats, Peter Barca in particular, were saying that the Burke campaign needed to get out front and define itself before the Walker folks did it for them. But over that period, we've seen the percent that don't know her come down from 70 in January to 59 okay. to 51, and now all the way down to 29. But her net favorability has been about 1 or 2 points more favorable than unfavorable since May. And so fewer people don't know her, but the positive and negatives have gone up in lockstep with each other. That's pretty strong evidence that the campaign messages and who's winning the ad wars has really been a dead heat, because if Walker were winning the argument, you'd think her unfavorables would go up more. If she were winning the argument, hers would go up. Instead, we've come down 30 points on the percent of people that don't know her, but the balance of opinion about her is almost exactly unchanged. So I think that tells us that both sides are scoring some points with their ads, but neither of them has hit on, you know, that mythical magic message that would suddenly change perceptions and change the balance in the race.
Where do you start talking about the photo ID issue? Because it's playing out in so many dimensions, as I alluded to. DOT and DHS are now scrambling to issue, well, the testimony in both the federal and the state courts, up to 300,000 people may not have photo IDs. Who are they, Mordecai, largely?
Well, largely they're lower on the socioeconomic scale, which I think means we're talking about Democrats, and which I think means we're talking about lower-income people and possibly a high proportion of African Americans in Milwaukee County. Now, remember that the turnout 4 years ago was about 2 million or so. So if there are 200,000 to 300,000 people who don't have a photo ID and who might not get it by Election Day, if it's still in effect on Election Day, that's 10% of the election. So it could well be that the Court of Appeals decision to lift the stay may well be the reason that Scott Walker wins, because 10% of the electorate got eliminated.
Well, let's play this out. If the photo ID requirement stays in effect for November 4, what do the polls look like? Because you have voters coming in, there's a photo ID requirement, I didn't know that. This is my photo ID, you'll have to accept it, we're not going to accept it. The whole absentee ballots that have already been mailed out have to be returned and sent back. Charles, your thoughts on this morass?
Well, it could be very interesting, shall we say. There is an alternative, which is a provisional ballot. So if you do show up and forget your ID, or you know for some reason it's not acceptable or it's questioned, you can still vote and file a provisional ballot. But that is set aside, and you then have to go to the county clerk or someone, I'm not quite sure who the right official is, maybe varies from place to place. You have to go there by, I believe it's Friday of election week, and show acceptable ID. If you fail to do that, then your ballot is destroyed. So I think in one version of the nightmare scenario, we have an unusual spike in the number of provisional ballots and a close election in which provisional ballots might be important. I don't think Wisconsin generally has had a lot of provisional ballots filed, but if we go back to Ohio, for example, in the 2004 presidential election, there were a lot of provisional ballots out and a very, very close election there. Now, we don't know whether there will be a big issue with this. If that 300,000 that Mordecai is talking about all show up at the polls on Election Day and all lack the requirement and produces huge provisionals or a huge drop-off in vote, that'll be important. But if that 300,000 is mostly in the gap between the 2.5 million that voted in the recall and the 3 million in 2012,
and the presidential,
then those are folks that would have stayed home either. I think we don't know is the important message here. In other states that have implemented photo ID, sometimes turnout has actually gone up a little bit, sometimes it's actually dropped off a little bit. it's very hard to know for sure what the impact is. But what is for sure is the uncertainty and the changing rules and potentially longer lines at polling places if this uncertainty and fumbling for the right ID slows the process down.
And that's this nightmare scenario. Do you agree with that nightmare scenario potentially, Mordecai?
Absolutely. We might see lines like Florida had or something like that. But if you try to peel back the onion even more, so let's say that a disproportionate number of low-income people in Wisconsin are, say, African-American and poor whites, poor Hispanics. And then there's another demographic that might not have ID, and that's sort of the little old ladies. It's the senior citizens, whether we're talking about urban areas or rural areas.
Who no longer drive.
Who no longer drive. They don't see a reason for it. They've always voted without having to prove who they are. So you don't quite know what's going to happen, and it's almost like the election is going to be determined that morning. The people who get up in the morning and they say, do I want to risk it? Do I want to do this? Or am I scared? Have I been seeing stories about the sheriff posting people at, you know, polling places? I don't want to have any contact with the law. Who knows how this will play out?
Or the election observers who are now allowed to sit within 3 feet of poll workers. But what about this scenario? I was born in Columbus, Ohio. My parents went to Ohio State. If I didn't have a driver's license, do you think I could get proof of who I am from Columbus, Ohio officials between now and November 4? I have a question whether I could do that. And the list of what you have to present when you apply for a photo ID can be pretty daunting, especially to some of these people who you just outlined. So, Charles?
Well, I was just going to throw in a little bit of the polling data. Where we see consistently 61% in this latest poll.
That's what you showed yesterday.
Seven times we've looked at this, mm-hmm. It's been between 60 and 64% support for photo ID, and about 30%, 35% opposition. It's clear that for a lot of people, they just think this is easy. I have a driver's license, I have to show ID at the airport or the bank or whatever. And so it doesn't seem like it's very onerous. The question is, in this 300,000 or so, it may be a lot more difficult. And the question is, does any of those difficulties, like we were talking about long lines and other things at the poll, does that filter out and affect folks with IDs who find it more problematic than they think? Or conceivably, this goes through pretty smoothly and we go, well, I guess, you know, it didn't cause a lot of problems. I think my point is simply we don't know, and it's an awful lot of change to go through with less than 50 days till the election.
And can I just add one more thing? And I think this shows us how good Republicans are at campaign tactics compared to Democrats. Republicans know exactly what the effect of these kinds of issues will be, because when you broke down partisans for Republicans liked photo ID more than Democrats, they're so good at campaign tactics. They're so great at wedge issues. I think the Democratic Party has been relatively poor in terms of how it's adapted to the reality of campaign tactics. So here was, I think, a pretty explicit way to help tilt the rules in their favor, and they're doing it, and it's working.
I want to cut. One of the issues you pull on, Charles, is the casino, and now it's up to 50%, mm-hmm. The Kenosha Casino.
Yep.
Well, let me ask a stupid question. Could Walker help himself if he approved the Kenosha Casino before November 4? Because I think the unfavorables is, what, 37% of the casino?
Yeah, it has been marginally working its way up, but I think the most striking thing is that in southeastern Wisconsin, now including Milwaukee, support is around 60%. Earlier, Milwaukee was much more reticent about it, but support's gone up there. So in this southeastern population base, 40% of the state's voters live in the Milwaukee media market. It's quite popular. I think there are some complications, legal complications. The governor has pointed to some of them about what happens with other casinos and so on. So it's maybe not quite as simple as it sometimes is portrayed. Nevertheless, having delayed the decision this long, it would be quite an October surprise to suddenly make a decision when all the evidence had been they would wait until after the election.
But do you think there'd be some potential upper for him if he did? there
might
pull
be
that October surprise?
There could be a little bit, but there could also be the downside that it would seem so motivated by electoral considerations. Not that any candidate for office is ever motivated by electoral considerations.
And it's possible his focus groups will show that it's worth taking a position just to add that increment of, let's say, 2 or 3%. Mm-hmm. But I think it's more likely that the election is going to be about the headline issues of the economy.
The jobs.
And in a sense, this is why we still hold elections, because you could look at Charles's results from yesterday, and if people are going to vote based on what do I think of Scott Walker, he might win, he might lose. If they vote based on 250,000 jobs, he'll probably lose. If they vote on is the state headed in the right direction, he'll probably lose. So in other words, it's not just that people are voting on lunch pail issues, it's which of the lunch pail issues is going to determine their vote.
Well, but let's frame that. Mary Burke says, Scott Walker, you didn't create the 250,000. Scott Walker's TV ad, we created 100,000. Which more resonates, do you think?
Well, I thought that was the fascinating thing, that we saw competing ads making opposite claims based on different data and different time periods. What you saw when the Burke ads were running more than the Walker ads was opinion moved in the direction of we're lagging behind. Then those ads largely went off the air and the Walker ads came on that said we're number three in the Midwest. And you saw opinion move back. The lagging went down, the keeping up went up. So this is an active debate. We're going to get new jobs numbers today as we tape this of national numbers, the gold standard numbers. We'll see where those turn out. But I think that is one active area of debate about how we're doing. The other that I wouldn't have anticipated 6 or 8 months ago is the budget. A central claim of the Walker administration to have solved the budget problems that he inherited is now faced with a very slight but still important revenue shortfall, followed by legislative reports that say we're looking at a substantial deficit going into the next year. Plus now the governor's agencies are submitting their budget requests, which show further needs for more revenue. So that has really opened a door to Burke, which she's using already in her ads, to now couple substandard performance on jobs with substandard performance on the budget. That's an opening. Governor Walker and his Republican allies are pushing back strongly on that, saying the budget is not in bad shape, we're going to be fine. But again, that's the argument that makes this election so interesting, and it's performance-based, appealing to those voters who are not so tied to partisanship that they may actually be convinced on these issues.
The agency, the Department of Health Services, runs the Medicaid program, which now provides health care for 1 in 5 Wisconsin residents. So apart from a lot of this political rhetoric over the structural deficit, DHS, Department of Health Services, we need $760 million more to cover MA recipients in the next biennium. And part of that is because, you remember Walker's policy, we're not going to accept the federal money to expand MA, so we're going to put 66,000 more people out in the federal marketplace, but we're going to take 99,000 more, a net addition of 33,000 to Badger Care. Those people cost money to serve. So you have, but did you poll yesterday on the budget issue and how, isn't that an eyes glaze over type thing?
Well, you might think so, but it's beginning to move. In January, at the time of the State of the State address that announced unexpectedly good budget pictures and was the justification for tax cuts, 49% said the budget was in better shape than it was a few years ago. Just 20% said worse. In our poll yesterday, better was down to 42, worse was up to 27. It's not a dramatic shift, but I think it's a consequential or an important shift. And those sorts of numbers are too technical under normal circumstances, but connected with the broader question of has he done a good job or not, I think they're important. You know, the governor can point to his tax cuts, which are generally popular. He can talk about other things that he's done that are generally popular. But 61% said we should take the Medicaid money. And that includes quite a few Republicans.
Fascinating.
And the common theme here is always dollars and cents. And so it almost becomes, which of the dollars and cents issue is going to be decisive in the election result?
Do we know that yet?
That's why we still hold elections.
I understand. Well, let me ask you this, as we close the discussion of the Gov's race, because I do want to get to Attorney General. What might be the wild card issue or the force that we haven't seen yet in the race for governor? Any speculation? Let me ask it this way. What about third-party spending? Because now that it's so tight, aren't the Dem and the liberal groups going to come in and shore up Burke? And now the NRA is going to come in and shore up Walker. Are they going to cancel each other?
Well, according to reports over the weekend, it looks like actually during the summer, Democrats had a slight advantage in total spending, which was quite surprising, though it's also reflected in other states as well, so it's not just here. But the balance going in through the fall surely is likely to favor the Republicans, if for no other reason Governor Walker has quite a bit more money of cash on hand than the Burke campaign. So not only the outside groups, but the campaigns themselves, actually, he has quite an advantage.
Potential wild card issue or player to be named later in this race for governor?
You know, we have so many things that have dropped that haven't changed things all that much, right? Whether it's the budget issue or the dope releases and things like that, those things don't seem to have moved very much. So I guess if it's going to be a unexpected wild card, I can't be expected to anticipate it at this point.
That's a fair answer in this climate where it changes.
But think of when Jim Doyle was running for re-election, and it was a pretty competitive race. And out of thin air, he invented a wedge issue about embryonic stem cell research.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, it moved the needle. I think that when we talk about some kind of October surprise, maybe there is a wedge issue that nobody's talking about today in the same way that Jim Doyle invented it. And by the way, it didn't work for Tom Barrett 4 years later, but it worked on that one-shot basis.
And I go back so far, I remember when then State Senator Russ Feingold invented an issue, BGH, bovine growth hormone, and he served only for 18 years in the state Senate. Let's turn to the Attorney General, another toss-up race, but the numbers of people who don't know both candidates still very high.
It's staggering. A month ago, 82% didn't know Susan Happ and 87% didn't know Brad Schimmel. This time it's down to 73% that don't know Happ, and it's still at 86 for Schimmel. So. And in Happ's case, that learning has been almost all negative. She was at 12% favorable, 7 unfavorable a month ago, still 12 favorable, but up to 14 unfavorable. With Schimmel, there's really been no change at all because there's been no increase in knowledge of him. Though, to put it in perspective, J.B. Van Hollen, after 8 years as Attorney General, 51% still didn't recognize his name.
That was very surprising.
It seems to me if we were in Wisconsin politics pre-Scott Walker, that the good prediction would be ticket splitting. In other words, whichever party won the governorship, the other party is going to win AG. Now we're in a different era where I think it's much more likely that whichever party wins the governorship is also going to win AG.
As she reminded me in our candidate interview, Susan Happ took 72 counties in the primary. That surprised me. Did it surprise you, gentlemen?
It certainly surprised me with... coming from Jefferson County, she didn't exactly have an overwhelming population base to build on. And setting aside the particular politics of the three-candidate race, it's pretty rare to see any statewide candidate sweep all the counties. And in quite a low key in terms of modern advertising, she ran a celebrated and much talked about commercial, but it didn't run that much and statewide.
You know, it either means that the Democratic primary voters were thinking about winnability, electability, and they went their way through the three candidates and they said, of all those three, she's the most likely to be able to win. So it could have been that factor. It also could have been a woman's vote. It could have been a sense of solidarity in the same way that Polish Americans on the south side of Milwaukee like to vote for people with Polish last names. Maybe it was a mix of both, but it truly was a surprise. She came out of nowhere.
Well, you mentioned the women's vote. It's intriguing to me that if the Democrats had a good November 4th, a majority of the Senate Democratic Caucus could be women. Would that do, Mordecai is a former member of the Senate, do you think that would mean less in-your-face partisanship, a more genteel Senate?
I think if you look at some of the current members of the state legislature who are women, one does not see that gentility.
Okay.
And so in a sense, there is no gender gap. To a certain extent, I think the glass ceiling has already been shattered. We don't have to talk about glass ceilings. We don't have to be surprised by the number of women in politics. But I do think that being a woman candidate who's a relative moderate, whether left of center, right of center, does give a gender advantage, does attract another layer of voters.
Okay. Before I ask my final question, anything that so intrigues you that we haven't talked about yet before my last question? No? Ready? Okay, gentlemen, you're both academics. If you were commissioning a grad student to do a thesis on this election, what topic would you assign she or he? Mordecai.
The undecideds.
The undecideds.
Absolutely.
Why?
Who are they? Why are they still undecided? And then how did they break?
Charles.
Turnout, turnout, turnout.
Oh, yeah.
Turnout, turnout, turnout. Wow. Fascinating. Thanks. We're about 7 weeks out. This has been a great discussion. I really appreciate it. Thanks to Mordecai Lee, Charles Franklin. Let's do this maybe a few days closer to the election. Gentlemen, we're at the Milwaukee Public Library. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.